This continues, lest it come to scandal, the genesis of Jewish kingship, from Lot and his daughters to Judah and Tamar and the book of Ruth. This is the second tape in the series. There were a couple of points which we left unresolved at the end of our discussion last week, and I'd like to get back to them today. Here's some questions that we raised, and here's what we got up to. Essentially, we had painted the following theory. We had argued that the story of Lot and Sodom is not coincidentally placed next to the story of Abraham and the entertaining of the guests in the beginning of Vayera, and that the stories are meant to reflect on one another. We suggested that there were a number of parallels between the story of Lot entertaining the guests in Sodom and Abraham entertaining the guests in his tent. They both seem to do it the same kind of way. And we began to suggest, and really Rashi himself suggests this in Vayera, that perhaps the Torah is trying to indicate to us that Lot's entertaining of the guests was an imitation of sorts of Abraham's, that Lot was not consciously aware of what Abraham had done, and indeed he could not have been. He was living in Sodom at the time, whereas Abraham was elsewhere. Nevertheless, having grown up in Abraham's household, he learned how it was that Abraham entertained guests, and therefore what he did was almost a carbon copy of what Abraham did. So there seems to be that connection. We'd also wondered sort of what it was that story number one was doing next to story number two, why it was that Abraham's entertaining of the guests, of these angels who come to his tent, is placed right immediately before the destruction of Sodom, the angels going to Sodom and the angels destroying Sodom. Was it just chronological or was it a thematic connection as well? And we suggested that perhaps the connection really between story number one and story number two, which is to say the story of Abraham entertaining the guests, and story number two, which is the story of God's decision to destroy Sodom and his decision to bring Abraham into the picture and discussing that, is perhaps Abraham's very great act of chesed in taking in people when he was felt so pained, physically pained, stood as an indictment, a cosmic indictment, as it were, of the people of Sodom, because the people of Sodom inhabited a city that not only failed to practice chesed, but had set themselves up against the notion of chesed in principle. So it's almost as if God asks himself, having known that the people of Sodom were very evil from before, but if human beings can reach such heights in chesed, then what room is there left for the people of Sodom, people who would seek to really justify their rape and violation of another human being on moral grounds as nothing but the playing out of a social contract which they had when they built the city, which is that anybody that comes into the city, we rape and we violate. So with this approach, we had argued that perhaps when the angels come to Sodom, we can explain their rather curious behavior by suggesting that they are coming to see whether Lot is deserving of being saved or not. Because why are they in the city? They're not in the city to destroy it. They can destroy it from outside the city. So why are they coming to the city? Are they coming to save Lot? If they're coming to save Lot, they should have immediately saved him. Why do they hang out in the city as if they've got all the time in the world? And all of a sudden, when they get to the feast, they decide, okay, time to save. It seems as if something happens in that feast to change their perspective or let's change their mission. It has now become a search and rescue mission for Lot, but only at that point. In line with that, we argue that perhaps that might explain the very curious statement of the sages that the reason why Lot served matzah at this feast, as recorded in the verse, is because it was Pesach. It's very strange to argue that Lot was observant of Pesach, and that's why he served matzah. But rather, we argue that perhaps the sages were arguing that it was Lot's personal Pesach, the Pesach offering, which is to say that just as the Pesach offering for the Jews served as something which saved them from death, really, at the 10th plague of Makat Becharet, so too this offering, so to speak, of the feast is going to be what saves Lot from destruction along with the people of Sodom. What is the medium by which each is saved? The medium of Pesach is that which separates one from their host society and says that I am not influenced by the degraded values of my host society, but I am in my own little world. Perhaps it's for that reason that the blood is placed on the door, right? Because the blood on the door is if to say that the doorway is the partition between my world and the rest of the world, as if to say that Egypt stops here. From here on in, we're monotheists. This is what it means to be a monotheist. Lot also places himself in the doorway. He puts his back to the door, faces the mob, and says, "Al na'achai tareyu," and offers a moral indictment and says that you're doing the wrong thing. And so doing is really saying that Sodom ends at my door. And once he does that, the angels are able to take him out. That also would explain why you have the language. You have some language also, which is the language of Pesach. Vayitma mea. It says that Lot wavered, right, when he was ready to go. And indeed, the Jews, when they left Pesach, we say v'lo yachlu lihitma mea. They were not able to waver. They were not able to take time. They had to go b'chipazon. That's why we have matzah, because matzah is bread that we had to bake in haste, because there was no time to waver, no time to hang around. Also, interestingly enough, we said that the ninth plague, immediately before the plague of destruction, in other words, if this is Lot's personal Pesach, then the destruction of Sodom would be analogous to what? To the tenth plague, right, which is the destruction of the firstborn. Interestingly, the ninth plague, the plague immediately before this, is the plague of darkness. And indeed, in Lot, we also have an analog to the plague of darkness, which is that immediately before the destruction of Sodom, when the mob is at the door, so the angels strike them with blindness, so they're not able to find the doorway. So you have blindness followed by destruction with Pesach. It seems to have all the same imagery. In any case, Lot is saved. Okay, if you accept that, though, there are a couple remaining problems. The central remaining problem I want to deal with today is that how do we understand the fact that in the middle of this wonderful feast, he sends his daughters out to get violated by the mob? That doesn't sound like such a nice thing. There are a couple of other points, other loose ends, which we need to tie up as well. I just want to raise a couple of them. First of all, Lot's wife. We mentioned that it just seems a very strange kind of thing, that here this poor lady looks back at Sodom and boom, she's a pillar of salt. I mean, you know, that seems a little temperamental of God. I mean, how do we understand that it's for such a trivial thing, when she looked back, it was so terrible, you know, and she gets turned into a pillar of salt. So how do we understand that? The second question we had, which, aside from Lot's wife, was the issue of this very strange Medrash that talks about Lot keeping his daughters for himself. Medrash says that, I'll quote it for you, Amar Rabba Seinu, but Noach Shabalolo Adam Moser Atzma Abinosav Falishto Vahorag Onerag, the way of the world is that a man, a husband, a father, would give himself over, would place himself, his own safety on the line to preserve the honor of his daughters and his wife. Vahorag Onerag, and would kill or be killed in order to keep them from being violated. Vizem Moser Abinosav Lizol Behem, and this guy gives his daughters out to the mob, to, as if they were playthings. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when God saw that, he said, La'atzmacha atam ashamran, you must be saving them for yourself. And indeed, so it happened. He committed incest with them later on. Now, we suggested that that is a kind of strange thing to say, because even though, you know, we would understand God not being happy with what Lot did, but to say that Lot was saving them for himself seems rather strange, especially since if he was saving them for himself, you would think that he would guard them for himself. He wouldn't throw them out to the mob. So what exactly is going on in that story? So again, we have the issue of Lot's wife, the justness of that punishment. We have the issue of the strange chazal that Lot was keeping his daughters for himself. We also have another strange thing which is worth, I think, exploring, was this notion of that another one of the quirks, so to speak, of this story of Lot and Sodom and Abraham and the guests is that we talked about story number one, story number three being parallel. The most obvious parallel between story number one, story number three is that Abraham's time with the angels is marked by hospitality, and Lot's time with the angels is marked by hospitality. And you have all the hospitality that each offers their guests to be very, very similar to each other. But there's one other detail, which is sort of the epilogue to each of these stories, which is also parallel and is interesting, which is that in each story, strangely, after the protagonist of the story extends themselves for the benefit of the guests, you have what? You have the promise of children in an unlikely way, right? We talked about this, that Sarah is promised that she'll have children even though it's very strange, and Lot has children even though it's very strange. Now, one is a nice kind of strange and one is a lousy kind of strange, but they're both strange. So it's almost like this, that hospitality followed by the promise of children, right? But then the question is, all right, so why is one children from incest and one children from, you know, in a nice kind of way? But also, more broadly, why should those two be connected? In other words, it seems like there's something about entertaining guests which is connected with this notion of fertility. And the question is, how do we understand that, right? And by the way, you see it in another story as well, interestingly, which is that the other story which this is all connected to, there's one other story in Tanakh and where you have, which is also parallel to at least one other story, maybe more, but one other story that I'm aware of in Tanakh, which is connected to Abraham entertaining the guests. Anyone know where it is? There's one, I'll give you a hint. But what does this remind you of in Tanakh, for all of you Tanakh experts out there? Not to be such an expert. I'll give you a hint, it's a haftorah. Where else do we have a childless woman who offers hospitality to a guest? And in the wake of offering hospitality to a guest is promised children. And she also thinks it's very strange and laughs. She says, don't joke with me when the purpose of a divine kind of being promises her children, just as the angels over here promise children. She's standing in the doorway when he promises her children, just as Sarah was standing in the doorway when Sarah was promised children. Later on, interestingly enough, she has a version of the Akedah story, just like Abraham did, where she goes to meet someone atop a mountain, goes to take a long journey having to do with her child on top of a mountain. She doesn't tell her spouse about the nature of that journey, just as Abraham didn't tell Sarah about the nature of the journey. She saddles the donkey herself to go on the journey, just as Abraham saddled the donkey himself to go on the journey. So what story is it? Anyone know? Book of Kings. Book of Kings. It's the story of Elisha and the Isha Shunami. So in this story, you have, again, hospitality followed by the promise of children. What happens? Elisha is going around and around. He doesn't have a place to stay. He comes to Shunam every year. Doesn't have a place to stay. She turns to her husband and says, hey, look, this guy, you know, he's a prophet. He has no place to stay. Let's make him an apartment, right? Let's give him a place. We'll give him a desk. We'll give him a bed, right? So remember the story, right? So they make him an apartment. He's so happy. What does he do? He says, what can we give you? You know, what can I do for you? She says, no, don't worry about it. Everything's fine. He says, no, Amina, what can I give you? And then Gehazi says to him, well, look, she doesn't have a child, right? Let's give her a child. So he says, next year you're going to have a child. So she says, no, you know, betoch ha'miyana yoshev, I'm fine, I'm doing okay, you know, I really don't need anything. He says, don't joke with me. He says, no, trust me, next year this time you're going to have a child. And so be it, next year this time she has a child. For our purposes, the interesting thing about all three of these stories, which is Abraham and the angels, Lot and the angels, and the Shunammite woman and Elisha, is that in all these cases you have hospitality followed by the promise of children, which leads you to suspect that there's something about hospitality that's linked to the promise of children. Now the question is why? And it was, why should those two things be linked? What you seem to learn from all these stories was, you know, if I was a Hasidic Rebbe, or even if I wasn't, you know, if somebody would say, what can I do to have children? I mean, it seems like if you extend yourself on behalf of guests, that's a good starting point, you know. Okay, so let me ask you the following. Let's start put some of this together. Let's look back to Lot's wife. Why is it she's turned into a pillar of salt? So I want to call your attention to an interesting Rashi, which gives a little bit of a different shade to understanding what the nature of that is. Let me read the Rashi and then ask you why it is that you think that Rashi helps at least a little bit with our understanding of this. Here's what Rashi says. Al tepid acharecha, she's commanded, everyone's commanded, don't look back. Okay? What does Rashi say? Ata hirshata imahim, why was it that the company were commanded not to look back? What was this business of not looking back upon Sodom? So Rashi says, Ata hirshata imahim, you were not so clean also. You were guilty as long with Sodom. Right? Ubizchut Avram atanitzol. And really, you are saved to some extent because you're the nephew of Abraham, because you're connected to his family. You are not worthy enough to be able to look upon their destruction and to be saved. Okay? Now what is Rashi saying here? First of all, what does this mean? You're not worthy enough to be able to look upon their destruction and be saved. How is Rashi changing the way that we normally would have viewed this without Rashi? How does Rashi help? Let me ask you that. I think Rashi helps because it's not that Lot or anyone of the company would be punished for looking back. It's something. It's not really a punishment anymore, right? It's not like, oh, you look back, boom, you're a pillar of salt. You shouldn't do such things, right? That you're punished. What is it instead? What it is rather, it's that, look, you're only a hair's breadth away from them anyway, right? So we're saving you. But for you to look back upon them is almost to become too close to them once more, that you become destroyed in them. In other words, it's almost like, to me, it's like reassociating. That's right, it's reassociating with them. It's either that you've reassociated with them, and if you reassociate with them, then you're taken in with them, or it's that you have to be really significantly different to look upon others. And I even see this with kids sometimes. I give you a candy because you did a nice thing. It wasn't such a wonderful thing, right? But if you're going to taunt the other kid that you got a candy and they didn't, so then you don't get your candy anymore. It wasn't that good. In other words, you don't have the candy to be able to look at him and say that you didn't get it. So that seems to be how Rashi is helping that. There's another Chazal which seems at first glance to be at odds with this Rashi, but that says something else interesting, which paints a little bit of a different picture as well, which is the following. If you look carefully at the text, you'll find that Lot ends up in a place called Soar. That is the place that he seeks refuge. However, Soar was not the original place that the angels had suggested that he seek refuge. Instead, the angels had said, why don't you go to the top of the mountain? Okay, go to the top of the mountain. He says, no, I don't want to go to the top of the mountain. Pentid bakani hara'a, lest evil find me there. Now, it's very unclear what he means, pentid bakani hara'a, lest bad things find me at the top of the mountain. What's he talking about? So the sages of the Medrash suggested what he was talking about. They said that Abraham lived in the top of the mountain, and he didn't want to go where Abraham lived. Pentit bakani hara, lest bad things happen to me there. What does the Medrash say? Listen to the following. Pentit bakani hara, kshayiti etzal anshei Sodom, hayakadosh baruch hu roa maaseh maaseh b'nei ha'ir, vayiti nira tzadik, ukadai li natzal. When I used to be in Sodom, Lot said, then, and so God looked at the people of Sodom and looked at me and said, yeah, all right, he's better than they are, right? So by comparison, I was better. But if Sodom is being destroyed and I'm going to go up and I'm going to be in Abraham's shadow, right? So, ukshavo etzal tzadik ani karasha, when I'm in Abraham's shadow, I'm going to look bad, then I'm for sure going to be destroyed, okay? Now, if you think about these two midrashim, are they consistent with one another or not, okay? Think about Medrash number one and Medrash number two. Medrash number one, why couldn't they look back? They couldn't look back because they're not so much of a tzaddik that they can look back and reassociate and see the destruction. Okay. Medrash number two, it's dangerous to go near Abraham because if I go near Abraham, so then I don't look as good as Abraham and I could be destroyed there. At first glance, there's something contradictory about these two Midrashim. They're opposites, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's like you think, okay, so where is Lot safe? If he's not safe in Sodom, so then you think, well, all right, fine. So he shouldn't be around bad places. So where should he go? Good places, right? Then he says, no, I can't go to good places either because then I look bad. Well, if good places aren't where you want to be because then you look bad, so you might as well go back to the bad places. No, then I'll be destroyed because I'm too close to the bad places. And this guy's not safe anywhere. Now, another Medrash commenting seemingly on these two Midrashim say the following, Kashem shahaneveh hara'a bodek, kach neveh hayafa bodek. The Medrash says, the same way that a bad neighborhood can put you in jeopardy, a good neighborhood can put you in jeopardy, right? Now, so, Lot gets it going and coming. Why is it that Lot gets it going and coming? One other issue which we raised last week, the irony of Lot's words. When Lot sends his daughters out to the mob, remember what he says? He says, oh, chas v'shalom, guys, don't violate these guests, right? Because ki al kein ba'u betel karati, because they've come to seek refuge underneath the beams of my house, right? Instead, give me these daughters, right? They're fine. Do whatever you want with them. Just don't touch these sacred guests, right? What's so ironic about these words? The rationale that he gives for the guests, first of all, is false. Second of all, could just as easily or more easily be applied to his own daughters. What do you mean the guests have sought refuge underneath your walls? First of all, it's not true. They were willing to sleep in the street. But even if it was true, and his daughters haven't sought refuge underneath the walls of his house, I mean, it's nonsense. If anybody is seeking refuge underneath the walls of his house, it's his daughters. So how is it that we understand that? I think in a way, this problem, that the irony of Lot's words, I think, can help us understand this strange Chazal, that Chazal said that he was saving his daughters for himself. What does it mean, he was saving his daughters for himself? How does that fit? What exactly is Lot's mindset? Lot is willing to offer these daughters. He is willing to say that the guests came under the shade of my house, but he somehow doesn't apply this logic to his own daughters. And then in the end, and somehow the sages saw that it's connected with this act of incest, which he semi-knowingly commits with them. How does that all add up? Let me ask you the following. Let's talk for a moment about incest, if we may. I realize it's a taboo subject, but I want to ask you the following. We live in a fairly promiscuous society in the United States. It's certainly not the way things were in the Middle Ages. You know, we have all sorts of promiscuity now. Besides for regular promiscuity, we have deviant promiscuity. Nevertheless, on the list of all sorts of deviant promiscuity that you have, you'd still have to put incest fairly low on the list. Now, even in a promiscuous society, incest is relatively localized. You know, it's not like in America we have rampant waves of incest. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It happens. It probably happens more than we know happens. And it's a terrible... It really does. I mean, it happens more than we know happens. So it's a bad thing. Nevertheless, there's a lot more unwed mothers in the inner city that are just being regularly promiscuous than there are people who are victims of incest, right? So I want to ask you this question. Why is it that incest is comparatively rare, right? Why is it that even in a licentious society, incest is still fairly rare? I'm going to make the devil's advocate argument. Why is the father not attracted to his daughters? A father can't see that his daughters are beautiful. He's blind. He doesn't see the beauty of his daughters. So if you have a promiscuous guy, so how come incest isn't more common? Yeah.
The parents' role is to protect their child.
Exactly. Okay, good. The answer is because it violates a core parental instinct. In other words, deep in all of our hearts, as part of our hardwired nature, there's something that repels us about incest. Incest does not feel like regular promiscuity. It feels really bad. There's something really yucky about incest, right? It intuitively, to any parent, crosses a line that makes it not even desirable. It's not even a Yetzer Hara on some level. Why is it? The reason why I think incest is comparatively so rare is because when a father looks at himself and looks at his daughters, it's not the case that his daughter's femininity, as it were, is that he has no relationship to it, right? He does have that relationship to it. But his relationship to it is not that of a husband, or not that of an equal, or not that of a potential suitor, but rather a very different relationship, which is that of protector, right? So he is related to her, even in terms of her femininity. It's not that that's irrelevant to him. It's very relevant to him. He just has a different role with it. His role is as a protector rather than suitor. He's above, right? He's up here. She's down there. He's not an equal of her and a potential consumer, so to speak. He's a suitor. Now, so therefore, I think that explains why there's no Yetzer Hara for incest. As a father looks at himself and says, no, I of course have a relationship with her. It's just not that relationship. It's this relationship. I'm a protector. Okay. Now, what is it? I think that this is exactly what Chazal were coming from when they looked at Lot. What did Chazal say? Listen to what they said. It makes perfect sense. They said to Lot, God saw the moment that he was willing to take his daughters and throw them out to the mob. He says, La'atzmacha tam ha-shamran. It's only a matter of time before you commit incest with them. What was he saying? He was saying, you're not their protector. If you don't see yourself as their protector, then it's only a matter of time before you commit incest to them. The only thing that keeps a father from incest, he doesn't love his daughters, he loves his daughters. He doesn't see they're beautiful, he sees they're beautiful. What keeps him from incest? It's only his understanding that he's up here, there to protect them. If he doesn't have that, if he doesn't see themselves as protector in that way, so it's only a matter of time before he commits incest, knowingly or unknowingly. And in fact, that's what happens with Lot. I think that's what the sages were saying here. I think that insight, though, gives us a window into Lot as a whole, which is now, if you add up all the pieces of Lot, here's what you have. Here you have this guy that is overflowing with love and care and hospitality for his guests, right? But in the middle of overflowing with love and care and hospitality to his guests, he throws his daughter to this mob in this show of complete lack of protection. And by the way, this is exactly what the verse wants you to think when the verse puts in his mouth, don't violate my guests. They've come under the protectiveness of my house, right? But the daughters haven't come under the protectiveness of your house. In other words, he has no sense of protectiveness for his own, but it's there for the guests. Something is very broken inside Lot's world, what's broken inside Lot's world? If he's not such a protective fellow, so how come he's so nice to all these guests? Right? Why is it that he's nice to the guests but not to his own daughters? I think the answer is that if you think about Lot, again, pull back the zoom lens to the whole story. Where did Lot learn chesed from? From his uncle Abraham. In other words, if you look back at the detail over and over, he mimics Abraham in every single thing, right? Exactly the way Abraham would have done it, he did it. What do you have over here? What you have, I think, here is imitated kindness rather than homegrown kindness. Okay, that's the difference. Right? What's the difference between imitated kindness and homegrown kindness? One is genuine and comes from something very internal inside of you, and then it grows naturally. But if it doesn't come from somewhere internal inside me, but I learned it from somewhere else, so I can go through the motions and I know what to do, but somehow the core of it is missing. Right? And this, I think, is what's happening with Lot. What is the core of genuine kindness? Where does genuine kindness really come from? What are the dynamics? How does kindness work when it's a genuine part of your personality? How is it different when it's imitated? What are you going to say?
It's applied to everything.
Yes and no, because you have to make judgments. It's prioritized. Kindness is always prioritized, right? In other words, if I always have decisions to make, and I have to make, and sometimes, by the way, I have to be mean, right? I mean, sometimes you have to put your family first and say no to the demands that guests would place upon you. We're going to have a private Shabbos this week because my kids need my attention, right? I mean, that comes from a place of genuine kindness, even though it looks like you're mean. But imitated kindness would never work that way, right? Imitated kindness says, no, kindness is entertaining. That's the kindness you see. Entertaining the guests, right? So I've got to entertain the guests. But you can neglect those other parts at home. You see this, by the way, often in you know, with mass movements of various kinds, or with any movement, even in Judaism, that begins, it always begins with from a very genuine place. But then what happens is the next generation, the followers, imitate it, and it's not as genuine anymore, right? And you see this in, I don't want to name names with movements, but you can use your imagination, right? It's a scary thing when you think of parents also. It's a lot easier for your kids to learn it's easier for them to, you know, to imitate the outer stuff sometimes than it is the inner stuff. I mean, I'm talking from yeshiva. I know my peers in yeshiva, when they would idolize a Rebbe, what would they do? They would talk the way the Rebbe would talk. They would take his mannerisms, the way he would walk, the way he would, you know, all of the externals are much easier if you idolize someone, right, than to say, but what really made him, right? It was his vision of Torah. You know, how can I acquire that same vision of Torah? It was the way that he had such respect for people. It was the way that he entertained you. You know, people idolize Rav Shach, right? One of the things Rav Shach was constantly advocating for was that yeshivas learn too slowly, right? And that they should learn vast amounts of bekiyas and have a great basis of knowledge and then be able to learn more in depth. No one listened to Rav Shach on this. If you think, if there's, and everyone's quoting Rav Shach, this little prat and this little prat and this chumrah and that chumrah, but the one thing that Rav Shach is for sure has Das Torah about, you would think, is how to learn. I mean, how you should be learning, right? But that's the one thing that no one listens to. That's part of the core of what made him who he was. I mean, he says, you want to know what made me who I was? It was being able to get this vast amount of Torah knowledge and then be able to pilfer it through. But so people don't say, I want to be like Rav Shach, so let me emulate him at his core in that kind of way. It's much more easy when you're emulating to pick up on the outside than to pick up on the inside. That's all I'm saying.
So then Lot is the opposite of Sarah or Elisha, because they were genuine with their acts of chesed and they were rewarded with children.
Ah, exactly. And he was rewarded with children in a broken kind of way.
Right.
So in other words, what you have with Lot is what I would call the legacy of broken kindness. What you have with Lot is the following thing. Lot can't live near Abraham. He can't live far from Abraham. He's indicted by everyone. Because when your kindness is not real kindness, when it's broken kindness, so then everyone indicts you. When you're real, so you can live anywhere. You can live in Sodom and be real. You can live near Abraham and be real. But when all you are is the trappings of someone else, so then if you're near Abraham, God says, you're just the trappings of Abraham. Who needs you? And if you're near Sodom, you're too near Sodom, and you can be destroyed along with Sodom, right? It's when it's just the outer trappings of kindness. What is it that makes kindness tick? What then I want to just get to the core of this for a second. Where is it that kindness really comes from when it's genuine? What is it that a person tells himself? What kind of person is it that is a real Baal Chesed? What is it, what do you, if you want to be a real Baal Chesed, what do you need to cultivate in your personality? What is it, how do you do it? How do you do it that is not just imitated? Because it is good to imitate. You know, you're right, you say, oh, I want to be a Baal Chesed like they are. Look, they're so good with people. Can't I be like that? What? How do you really cultivate Chesed inside your personality? I'm going to make actually two arguments here at the same time. Okay, start with argument number one. The core verse in the Torah. What's the verse in the Torah? The core verse of the Torah that mandates Chesed. Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. There's something very strange about that verse. Love your neighbor as yourself. Listen to this. Love your neighbor as yourself. What does that imply?
You love yourself.
You love yourself. Right? So it says, everyone knows you love yourself. Now, love your neighbor like that. I think that that's more than just a nicety. There's something in that verse that's getting to the core of where Chesed comes from. Because you can't, what this verse is really saying is that it's impossible to love someone else without loving yourself. You just can't. Why? Because how does love happen? What is love? In other words, you have to define love really at its core. What really is love? Love is what? How do you define it? What's love? What's it all about? What do you tell yourself when you're loving towards someone? What do you want to do? How does it work? What kind of energy does love come from? Where does it? What are you doing? What do you want to do for them? It's giving. It's like expansive. Where is that giving coming? It's coming from me inside here, right? And I want to like overflow. It's like a glass. And then it's like overflowing. Goodness overflowing. The chesed is by nature an overflowing kind of thing. That's the way it works. Now, if I'm empty, I can't overflow, right? You can only overflow if you're full. So in other words, the overflowing is I have a sense of goodness and well-being inside myself. Now, I want to give that to, I feel good, I want you to feel good. I want to make you feel this experience that I've felt. And by the way, this doesn't mean that you have to live a plush life. I mean, you can be in a, God forbid, in a concentration camp, but feel this. You can have a sense of personal well-being in whatever situation it is and say, I feel good, I want to share that with others. I want other people to feel that. If you have an experience that feels nice for you and you're a loving person, you say, this felt so nice for me, I want to be able to make other people feel this way. I mean, it's a normal kind of thing. Goodness becomes more real almost when I can share it. I don't even feel it as much if I'm among myself, which is why, interestingly enough, a todah, right, a todah offering, a Thanksgiving offering, which is the culmination of a feeling of well-being, right? Do you know a todah offering always needs to be brought with 40 loaves of bread? Why 40 loaves of bread? And it has to be eaten within 2 days. Who can eat 40 loaves of bread in 2 days? 40 people, that's the answer. But there's no such thing as bringing a Thanksgiving offering and not inviting your friends to share it with you. That's why we want to invite people to our bar mitzvahs. That's why it's so meaningful, right? Because it's not enough for me to celebrate this. I want to share this feeling with other people.
That's also for like children. People still do. People want to be around people and surrounded by people, even in a sad time.
You want to be, but there you want it the other way. There it's the other way. There I feel needy, so I want you to give to me. I want you to support me. The whole notion of comforting an avel is just to be there for them. It's the other way around. Then chesed, I am there for you, and in comforting an avel, you are there. You're there for me. You see this in another chazal, right? In very famous words. Im ein ani li mili, ukshani la'atzmi ma'ani, right? What do these words mean? Im ein ani li mili, if I'm not for myself, who will be for me? Ukshani la'atzmi ma'ani, if I'm only for myself, then who will be for me? Rav Shimon Shkop, brilliant thinker, in his introduction to his monumental Talmudic work, Sha'arei Yosher, develops a theory of chesed around this aphorism. And in short, it's a very beautiful theory. He's bothered by the notion that there's something contradictory, that you seem to find contradictory trends in Chazal, that there are certain Chazal that suggest that the purpose of life is to be altruistic and to give towards others. But there are other Chazal that seem to suggest that love of self is primary, right? Which is that given a choice between your needs and my needs, I choose my needs. The famous example, right? Two people in the desert, one canteen, I drink the water, you die. Well, if altruism is what life is all about, so why don't I give you the canteen, right? So how do you resolve this tension between the purpose of life being to live for the other and to be altruistic. And yet, when push comes to shove, my own needs come first. So how do we understand this? It says, even v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, but loving yourself is primary. But even he says, v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, is in the negative, that we Chazal phrase it, don't do to your others what you wouldn't have done unto you. But so, without getting into all of his examples, basically the theory that he argues is that he has a slightly different reading of that aphorism. Here's how he reads it. If I'm not for myself, who will be for me? Ukshani la'atzmi. However, if my I is only la'atzmi, my little self with a small s, then ma'ani, what value is that I? In other words, here's how he's reading it. He's reading it that how does chesed work? What's the dynamic of chesed? What you do is you take that self-love that you feel, and you say, okay, love is paying attention to needs. I pay attention to my own needs. I understand my needs. I take care of them. That's self-love. Okay. Now, I feel that I want to expand. I want to give. It's expanding your sense of self in a certain way. What I do is I say that, okay, I have a wife. I have kids. They're part of this broader organism called a family that I'm a part of. There's this larger sense of self. It's not just little me, right? There's a larger me, which is this family. So I bring them into this world of this I, and I say, I want them to share what this little I has. I want this larger I to have. Then he said, but you know what? The I is a lot larger than just my family. There's another concentric circle. There's my community. There's my friends. There's this organism here called my neighborhood, and I'm friendly with them, and this is all part of this larger self of which I'm a part. And therefore, of course, I want it to overflow to give them too. And ultimately, you see all of humanity as part of this larger self and say, there really is this community of humanity that's really one self, and I'm part of that. So the idea is that self-love becomes the engine for this broader love of community, and that's what Hillel meant. He says, Ukshani la'atzmi, when my I is so small that it's only me, then ma'ani, then what's the value of that I? That I needs to become more expansive to be valuable. That's genuine kindness. When it comes from inside and it radiates outward, a kindness like that would never leave your daughters behind. Because the daughters are one of those inner concentric circles. Of course I'm going to be attentive to those needs. But a kindness that comes from the outside, that comes from imitated kindness, so it only gets the outer layer. It doesn't penetrate in sometimes into the inner layers. You can find yourself being nice to all the guests, right? But not being nice to the daughters. We'll come back to this in a minute. What's the legacy of broken kindness? Lot, in the middle of his Pesach offering, sends out his daughters. Later on, he commits incest with them. Two children are born. One of them becomes the maternal ancestor of the Davidic dynasty. The two children are Ammon and Moab. But their names are very strange. Ammon and Moab. Do you remember what the names mean? Moab. Me'av. From my father. Ammon. Ami. Right? My nation. An oblique reference to incest. Both of these names refer to the act of incest. From my father. Is there anything strange about this? I mean, if God forbid, and you were a victim of incest, would this be, you know, can you imagine, how could you possibly say that? You name your child from my father, and this is how you call them. So if you had a child like that, that's not what you would do. If you named the child this way, what does it mean? I think it's very sad if you would name a child this. It's very sad.
It's a constant reminder.
Yes, it is a constant reminder. It's almost like you're thinking, this is the relationship I had with, you know, you think, you know, victims of incest. What is the legacy of being a victim of incest or having been involved in an incestuous relationship with your father? What's horrible about it is here is your father who you love, and yet he did this terrible act to you, but you want to lie to yourself and say what? That, well, my father I love, and he can't be evil, right? So what do? You rationalize the act and say, well, this is just part of our, it's like a little strange, but it's part of our relationship. That's how you can get messed up, right? Because you can see this as, you can almost see this as normative, right? Because my baseline for normative is how my parents deal with me. That's how my parents deal with me, even though it feels bad. But so in other words, if to name your child after an act of incest is almost to say, here's the relationship I had with him. It's almost like it's better than no relationship. It's a warping of the father-daughter relationship. Any act of incest is going to warp the father-daughter relationship because it's the protector not being protector and acting. It's a warped thing to do, and it leaves a warped relationship in its wake. Now, if we would put ourselves for a moment in the shoes of the daughters of Lot, or the shoes of a victim of incest, of sort of this quasi-knowing incest in a drunken state, after your father had sent you out to the mob. Okay, now let me ask you this. What is the legacy of Ammon and Moab throughout the generations? Ammon and Moab, if you think about it, Moab, interestingly, are the nations, the nation of Moab is the nation before Ruth, by the way, that the Jews were not allowed to intermarry into. And the reason they were not allowed to intermarry is very fascinating. Does anyone know why? Why couldn't they intermarry? Yes? Adavar asher lo kidmu etchem belechem ubamayim. Because when the Jews came out of, they had their manna, they had their water, but the people of Moab didn't know that. And they came to the people of Moab and asked, could you give us provisions? And the people of Moab didn't give them lechem and didn't give them mayim. They didn't give them hospitality. Now think about that for a moment. If you were the victim of incest and your father had thrown you out to the mob before and had said to the guests, and you had heard him say, God forbid, don't violate my guests. They've come under the shade of my house. Take my daughters, and you were one of those daughters. What would be your perspective on chesed? Would you be like, yeah, I'll have 13 people in my house every week for Shabbos? No, that's not the way you relate to chesed, right? Chesed brings up those memories of, chesed means, chesed is betrayal. Chesed is, yeah, you care for the others, but you don't care for the own. The legacy of broken kindness is Ammon and Moab. What Moab will not do is extend themselves in hospitality. It's almost like this ingrained trait, and they can't do it. But interestingly, Moab has another legacy too. The other legacy of Ammon and Moab is that if you know, Moab hired Bilam to curse the Jews because they were afraid of them. When Bilam was unsuccessful, according to the Medrash, the next thing that happens is that the Jews commit promiscuous acts with the daughters of Moab. Right? Apparently the daughters of Moab enticed the Jews. So what do you have here? You have a situation where they didn't do what? They didn't offer lechem umayim, bread and water, but they offered themselves promiscuously. What does it sound like? That's right. It sounds like Lot and his daughters. In other words, this, again, I think is the legacy of broken kindness. And now it gets back to the question of, right, of fertility and the promise of children and its connection to hospitality. Here, too, even in the twisted version of Ammon and Moab, you see the connection between fertility or sexuality on the one hand and chesed on the other hand. They extend them to themselves promiscuously, but not, right, in chesed and giving lechem and mayim. Interestingly, by the way, lechem and mayim, often in Chazal, is a euphemism. It's a euphemism for sexuality. You find it in, for example, when the wife of Potiphar is seducing Joseph. Joseph says, I can't take you because my master has given me everything except for you. But before that, it says that he left everything in the hands of Joseph except for the bread which he ate. Ki malachem asher hu ochel. Except for the bread which he ate. Chazal say it was a euphemistic reference to his wife. With Yitro also, when Yitro tells his daughters to call Moses and let him eat bread with us, it's a euphemism for marriage. Right? In other words, and he does, offers his daughters in marriage to him. So in other words, there's two sides of bread. There's the real bread of lechem umayim, but there's the euphemistic side of bread, which is how they in fact offer themselves in promiscuity. So what's this connection between the sort of fertility in the sexual realm on the one hand and hospitality on the other hand? So I think the connection is fairly simple, which is the following. A while back, I remember I was at a seminar, a woman came up to me afterwards and she says, I don't understand why Jews don't intermarry. What's wrong with intermarriage? I mean, we're supposed to love everybody, so I'm loving this non-Jew. I mean, I'm not supposed to love everybody. It's love, right? Mm-hmm. So how would you answer that? She says, doesn't Judaism preach love? What, are you racist? Do I love them and not these? What's going on? It's love, right? I'm in love with this fellow. I'm loving him just like it says. So there's a basic fallacy here, that she's using a word falsely for two different things. There's two different kinds of love that she's confusing, isn't she? When it says love everybody, what does that mean? So I'm supposed to be what it's supposed to be hospitable. I'm not supposed to be promiscuous, right? Right. So you could say, right, then everyone should be right. Free love of the 60s is love everybody, right? But that's not what we had in mind when the Torah said "Va'ahavta l'rayecha kamocha." So what's happening over here? What there is that there's two kinds of love. They both go by the name love, but they're two very different things. What are these two different kinds of love? The sign of one of them is hospitality. The sign of the other is fertility. They're both expressions of love, but they're two different realms. They're very different kinds of love. Love number one is hospitality. What kind of love is that? Define that love. How do you define that love? First of all, to whom is that applicable? Particular people or everyone? Everyone. You should be hospitable towards everyone. This is the kind of love that you have to the world at large. It's expansive. It's public. Can I do this in public? Yes. There's nothing wrong, right? You bring everyone to home. Put a sign in your house, right? Everyone, kol dich bin yetzei v'yechol. Anyone who's hungry, let them come in. This is the kind of love that you offer to everyone. This is public love. This is an expression of my feeling of brotherhood with mankind. This is the expression of the large I, my feeling of essential brotherhood, that everyone I can do chesed with. That's what we mean when we say love everyone, right? But there's another kind of love that's a different kind of, related, but different. And its symbol is fertility. What kind of love is that? It's not chesed love. It's not public love. It's not world love. What is it? What kind of love is it? It's exclusive love. It's a sacred, exclusive, private kind of love. Its emblem is sexuality. It's the love between one person and their soulmate. That love is by definition exclusive. That love is not, is inappropriate when it's to the whole world. It's inappropriate when it's public. It's private. But nevertheless, we do use the same word for both of them. And they are related. It's love, right? And if I'm a loving person, then I'm a loving person, right? But the two are not the same. And to confuse the two is not kosher. Okay, so now, look back to all these narratives. What do you have? Hospitality followed by the promise of children. It makes perfect sense. What's it saying? It's saying that if you can extend yourself in fraternal love to mankind, to your brothers, then God's reward for that is that even the love in your private realm will be productive as well. That you can have children, that love will work out for you, and you will have children, and you will have fertility in that private realm. And if your hospitality is real and genuine in that public realm, then the children that are begat from that, that you get from that, are real and genuine and nice also. But then there's the children of broken kindness. Because there's another kind of hospitality, the imitated kind of hospitality, just the shreds, the outer shreds of hospitality. That hospitality is enough to get you saved from Sodom. But that's all it's enough to do. It can't get you any more than that, right? So therefore, if you're too close to Sodom, you'll be destroyed. If you're too close to Abraham, you'll be destroyed. And that kind of hospitality also will get you a blessing of children. But that kind of hospitality is broken, and the children that come from it are broken. It's the children of incest. So the sexuality that it begets is broken sexuality, and the hospitality is broken hospitality. And the legacy is the legacy of broken kindness. Because what happens now with Ammon and Moab? Ammon and Moab have a relationship to hospitality, and they also have a relationship to sexuality. But fascinatingly, it's the reverse, which is that how is it that Ammon and Moab relate with hospitality? They have this complex against hospitality. I'm going to be hospitable when my mother's father, threw me out to the mob. Instead, I'm going to take care of the guests. No, the hospitality is dangerous. Hospitality is betrayal. So what do? They take hospitality and they make it inappropriately private. Hospitality only is in the private realm. It's among us. It's not something we extend outward, right? Inappropriately private. In place of hospitality, how do they relate to that world outside? Through sexuality, right? So what they do is they promiscuously relate to the Jews. And what they're doing is it's the two lechens. Right? But instead of the lechem of the bread, of giving the real lechem of bread, you give the private intersexuality publicly outside, and that's what you give. It's very interesting, by the way, that the Jews are known. We have three national traits. Do you know what the three national traits are? Jew says, if you want to know what a Jew is, you just look for these traits. You remember what the traits are? Rachmanim, Baishanim, Rachmanim, Baishanim, and Gomle Chasadim. Rachmanim, you're compassionate. Baishanim and Gomle Chasadim. The way I would see these is as a tripod. Rachmanim is a certain emotional state that you feel compassionate. Okay? But compassion can have two different manifestations. It can manifest itself in the public realm and in the private realm. In the public realm, it manifests itself as hospitality. I volunteer for Meals on Wheels. In the private realm, compassion will manifest itself as sexuality, a normal and healthy sexual relationship in a committed relationship, right, in one spouse. Mm-hmm. So those are the two manifestations of the feeling of compassion with the two different kinds of relationships I can have. So I have Rachmanim, Baishanim. What does Baishanim mean? They have a sense of sexual modesty. What does that mean? They understand the limits of sexuality, that sexuality is limited to the private realm. Where does sexual modesty come from? It comes from, and I think that we in America, by the way, are very messed up when it comes to understanding sexual modesty. We have no conception of the concept. It's just foreign to us. Right? The pages of all those supermarket tabloids scream to you that if you have a sense of sexual modesty, then you're not comfortable with your body. Then you, this is the thing, right? If you're comfortable with your body, then you'd flaunt, you know, you have it, you flaunt it, you want to go. It's a complete misunderstanding of this distinction between the kinds of love, right? If I have it, I flaunt it. No. If you have it, then you understand how precious it is, and you understand its role, and it's here for the private relationship. So the supermarket tabloids will lie to you, and they'll tell you. Wendy Shallot, by the way, a great book, if you read the Return to Modesty. She writes for Commentary, and she wrote this book really on Rediscovering Modesty, the Lost Virtue, or something like that. She calls them when she first discovered modesty. She discovered them through what she called modesty nicks, which was her name for frum women, right? That she saw in college, right? And she saw this woman was showing her grandchildren, and she's showing her, and they're engaged, right? And she says, if they're engaged, then how come they're not holding each other? How come they're not touching? There's this thin line of sky between them, you know, in the picture. And then she says, don't they love each other? So, oh yes, they love each other very much. Here's the picture after they're married. And they were holding each other, right? And then the next picture is that on the beach, you know, and she's covering her hair and she has a little kid. And she said she was overtaken with emotion when she saw these pictures. She couldn't explain it. She says, I then understood the life cycle of the modesty nick. There was no touching, touching, and hat. Right, that's how she put it, right? But there was stages, and it wasn't because you didn't love, and it wasn't because you were uncomfortable with your body. It was understanding of a right time and a right place, and it was that you were saving yourself for a real relationship. And the lie, by the way, which secular culture will have us believe, I think, about modesty is that modesty is prudery, is a damping down of sexuality, and that if you really were comfortable with sexuality, so then it's only because you're uncomfortable with it, so you have to cover yourself up. And it's exactly the opposite, which is that a real comfortability with sexuality, an understanding of where it is, understands that it is something by nature private and becomes cheapened when it's public. And that's natural, and it's intuitive, and it's part of the way we relate to it. Let's just leave it at that. There's when it's left in that private realm, that is where it shines, and that is where it's really something. So the traits of Jews, again, are Rachmanim. One expression is Baishanim, to understand the limits, right? That there's sexual modesty. There's a place for sexuality. It's within this particular relationship. And Gomlei Chasadim, right? Which is the public realm of Chesed. Compassion expressed publicly to offer hospitality to people. And to understand the balance that Gemilas Chesed is for here, and I do that. And sexuality is here, and I do that. And both are expressions of Rachmanus, of this feeling of compassion, this feeling of wanting. And compassion is that feeling of wanting to nurture another, right? That's really what it's about. By the way, the word Rachmanus comes from what? Rechem, right? Rechem is womb. The womb is the organ that nurtures, right? And the feeling of Rachmanus, or of compassion, is a desire to nurture another human being, desire to overflow and to be able to give you what you need to be everything that you are. Right, the one expression of that in the public realm is hospitality. Expression in the private realm can be sexuality. The two faces of that relationship, right? But the legacy of broken kindness is exactly the reverse. It's where sexuality becomes public and Gemilas Chesed becomes inner and becomes private.
So that's why they gave them those horrible names, to get very public.
In a certain way, that's right. It was publicizing that sort of that messed up aspect of it. That's right. Okay, we're going to stop here. When we come back, eventually we're going to get to the story of Ruth. and everything that we've said now is really necessary, I think, for understanding the story of Ruth, because everything that happens in the story of Ruth happens against the backdrop of what it means to come from Moab. Okay, so all of this will become very important. There's another piece that we need to know of to understand Ruth. That is to understand where Boaz comes from. And Boaz comes from the union of Yehuda and Tamar. So Ruth's legacy is from Lot's daughters. Yehuda and Tamar is the beginning of Boaz. What's happening in Ruth is the coming together of all of the loose ends from Yehuda and Tamar with all of the loose ends from Lot's daughters. And that, I think, is what's happening in that story. There's still some more to be said on this, but we're out of time. So maybe when we come back next time, we'll finish up with that and we'll begin with Yehuda and Tamar. So I'll see you then. This is the end of tape 2. The series continues at this point on tape 3.